supporters for re-regulation speak out, the environmental impacts of fuel dumping, manslaughter charges filed for Concorde crash, and an in-depth look at the Air Force tanker situation. All that, including an interview with Cranky Flyer himself as Brett Snyder masters the word associations and gives his insight to the latest in the industry. Welcome to the rather lengthy Episode 5 of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 5th episode of the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is Courtney, and with me, as always, is Max Flight. Max, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Thanks, everybody, for listening in again.
Max, this is our first milestone podcast, I guess. Number 5, that's like halfway to 10. Isn't that something?
It's a half milestone.
It's a half stone.
It's a half stone, but it's impressive nonetheless, at least to the two of us, I think.
Well, we have a ton of airplane geek stuff to talk about in this podcast, so what do you say we jump right into it?
Let's go.
First up for news comes from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The article is titled, "Re-regulation Gets a Push." Now, those of you will remember that this came from some comments that Robert Crandall, who was the ex-American Airlines chief, made a few months ago. He says, "It is time to acknowledge that airlines look and are more like utilities than ordinary businesses." Now, this is what he said during a speech June 10th on the Wings Club. It's an industry group in New York. This is quite an audacious, if that's even a word, remark, you know, and especially coming from somebody who is as well-respected as Robert Crandall is in the industry.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, certainly Robert Crandall knows a thing or six about running an airline that we don't appreciate. But still, it was kind of a surprising suggestion. And the thing that pops into my mind is, gee, be careful about what you ask for because you might get it. And I'm not sure that's what you'd want to see.
Point here isn't that Robert Crandall's going off his rocker. The point is that, wow, if Robert Crandall's mentioning this, then is this something that the rest of us are missing out on? I believe that a good part of Robert Crandall's career with American was in the regulated environment. I gotta say, there must be something that he's seeing that I'm not, because there's so many benefits to regulation, to deregulation rather, that he doesn't address with the suggestion, and what re-regulation does not address. The first being the economic benefits of deregulation. I mean, airfares have come down so much that the American public has really gone out and been more willing to spend their money either on vacations. The tourism industry has just been booming. A large part, you could postulate, as a result of deregulation.
That's right, Court. And, you know, it's surprising that it's not just Crandall. I mean, Steve Cohen, the Democrat from Tennessee, has talked about, you know, restoring regulation, labor unions, the IAM, the Airline Pilots Association. There are others out there who are also calling for at least some form of government re-regulation. And, you know, maybe it's just born out of frustration with the seeming inability of the airline industry to kind of keep its, you know, financial and economic health in order, and people are getting kind of desperate perhaps and thinking that, well, you know, if they can't do it on their own, maybe we need to have the government do it for them again. But it's kind of a scary thought.
And I've actually heard some very convincing arguments for the exact opposite of what Robert Crandall is suggesting, and that is that the industry is already, or is still, too regulated. You look at the problems the industry is having right now, and a lot of people are looking at some of the bankruptcies, the pension buyouts, the bailouts after September 11th, and they're saying, whoa, the government, you have regulated this too closely and propped these airlines up too long that we are now seeing the repercussions of that. The marketplace has not been able to react in a true deregulated environment. So there's definitely some credence to be lent to that part of the argument. I understand where Robert Crandall and Cohen and that group are coming from, as it was a much easier and more profitable time for the airlines during the regulated time. But I'm definitely not on board with this one.
You know, I think the best quote on all this came from Alfred Kahn, who you probably remember was the chairman of the Civil Aeronautics Board, who really was the architect of deregulation back in 78. And I love what he said about this notion of re-regulating. And I'll just quote from the article. He says that at a time when we were increasingly worried about the energy problem, I don't view it as my highest aspiration to make it easy for people to jet all over the world cheaply. The only way to preserve the level of airline service the public has come to expect, Kahn said, now quoting the article, not Kahn himself, is to subsidize it. And now this is quoting Kahn, and I am not ready to subsidize it, especially given our energy problems. I'd rather subsidize rail transport or even bus transport. Interesting point.
We are going to move on, and that's to our next news article. This one comes from the Chicago Tribune. Not necessarily an article that you may, or a news item that you may have heard about, but Max and I both thought that this kind of sparks an interesting debate. Sparks is a bad word for this one, but
yes, it is.
This from the Chicago Tribune: jet fuel dumped over Lake Michigan likely will degrade within a week, experts say. A Japan-bound commercial airliner landed safely at O'Hare International Airport Monday afternoon after one of its engines malfunctioned over the northwest suburbs, but not before it had to dump about 4% of its total fuel load over Lake Michigan in order to land. It was a 777-300, the ER version, and they had a right engine fail. They did have to dump, it was 1,450 gallons of jet fuel, and this is all with 189 passengers on board. Max, I did some very in-depth airplane geeks research. Assuming at $4 a gallon, that 1,450 gallons cost them $5,800.
Wow.
And 189 passengers, that was about $31 a passenger.
Yeah, I mean, an airline is not going to dump fuel just on a whim. You know, there has to be something motivating that. And it's interesting that actually not all aircraft can dump fuel. Some are designed with the piping and pumps to dump fuel. Others are not, and in other cases, they're offered as options to the airlines. It really all revolves around the maximum takeoff weight and the maximum safe landing weight. And obviously, the maximum safe takeoff weight is greater than the landing weight. And so when you have a return early in the flight, as was the case here, you have to, you know, do what's required for the safety of the landing. And in this case, the airline decided that, you know, pumping out some of the fuel was required to ensure that the minimize the risk of anything happening with the landing.
It does get a little controversial because an aircraft can land over that max landing weight.
Right.
Pushes the envelope. You're not quite sure what the aircraft is going to do, and it does become a safety issue, but it has been known to happen. There are airliners all over the country and all over the world that have higher max takeoff weight than max landing weight that do not have fuel dumping systems. If something like this were to happen, then they would land overweight. Really, this is an issue from an environmental aspect, and I think what's telling from this is that we're starting to see news articles focused around this, where this has been happening for years. You know, 727s have fuel dump systems. With the movement towards a greener aviation system, this is really kind of starting to get out into the forefront.
That's true. And you know, when you dump fuel, a lot of it's going to evaporate in the atmosphere, and you know, if any of it reaches the ground, depends on your altitude when you dump. And I think in this particular case, some portion of the 1,450 gallons reached the water. But whether it's going into the air or into the water, it's still dumping fuel into the environment, which is as you say, Court, is going to get a lot of scrutiny, especially these days. If anyone listening is interested in kind of seeing some video of what a fuel dump looks like, there are some clips on YouTube. If you go to YouTube and just do a search on fuel dump during flight, those four words, you'll find a number of them. The one video with that exact title is actually a view of a 767 dumping fuel filmed through the window by a passenger. But there's some other fuel dump videos you can find on YouTube as well.
And we'll make sure that we get one of those in the show notes, so make sure you go to airplanegeeks.com and we'll have that video on the site for this episode.
Great.
Moving on to our last news article, at least for now. We're going to save one for the email section. And this comes from the Associated Press. Continental ordered to trial in Concorde explosion. A French judge ordered Continental Airlines and five people to stand trial on charges of manslaughter for the 2000 crash of a Concorde jet that killed 113 people.
Yeah, this is a really interesting story, especially as it will be viewed by Americans. The issue really revolves around, you know, personal liability for aviation incidents. And the culture in the U.S. is that, you know, only in rare circumstances are individuals considered to be or charged with any kind of breach of personal liability in a case like this. And the thought is that you want investigations to be open and without, you know, fear of reprisal against individuals. If, you know, a pilot is involved in an incident and is concerned that he may go or she may go to jail as a result of what happened, then that's going to tend to color the report that particular pilot provides.
From the article, it quotes, French investigators say the crash was caused in part by a titanium strip from a Continental Airlines DC-10 that was lying on the runway when the supersonic jet took off. Two of the individuals to stand trial are employees of the U.S. carrier. Two other employees were employed by Aerospatale, the maker of the Concorde, and the precursor of the playmaker Airbus. The fifth is an employee of the French Civilian Aviation Authority. Now, what surprises me, you know, there's all sorts of corporate-on-corporate legal action that goes on in the world that we never hear about. That Continental Airlines is ordered to stand trial didn't surprise me as much. You know, kind of, you know, rolled my eyes a little bit at it. But there are five individuals that they are going after, which what appears to be, in effect, criminal charges. You've got two individuals from Continental Airlines. You've got two from who I guess would now be Airbus, and then one from the French version of the FAA. What's going to happen to these people? How can they possibly be responsible for this crash other than maybe negligence that's even going to be circumstantial at best? And to be blamed individually for this crash, that really shocked me.
It does seem crazy, and it's you know, you have a DC-10 part that's lying on a runway, and it causes this obviously terrible accident. You know, one approach is to say, okay, who caused that piece of titanium to be on that runway, and let's find that person and put that person in jail. Another approach that I would think would make, you know, more sense is, you know, what is the system that allowed this piece of metal to end up on the runway? Forget the individual. You know, what is the process in place? What are the controls in place? What's the quality system in place that should prevent incidents like this from occurring? Don't go after the guy. Go after the process, because that's the way you'll get to, you know, a more meaningful solution that'll keep these kinds of problems from happening in the future.
Really, they do have a lot to learn from a lot of the U.S. systems that we have set up here, and I would assume that it's the JAA does a lot of this as well. But one in particular that comes to mind, and that is the NASA ASRS system. That's the something SRS.
The ASRS.
I forgot. Something reporting system. But effectively what it is it allows a pilot to report an issue. Now, maybe the pilot did something wrong, but they can report the issue as a problem with a system. Like, you know, I took the wrong taxiway, and I think that maybe we should look at the process because, you know, it was easy for me to do. Now, you can't get, you know, get out of jail free card for something that you did intentionally, but really, it is a goodwill attempt to fix the process and make it safer. Now, what I think they're going to have problems with industry-wide if they continue this type of accusation and what seems to be criminal charges is you're going to have people scared to death to bring anything up, and it's really going to compromise safety because you're not going to know where the safety problems are.
Exactly. And, you know, we've seen, there's precedence for this kind of thing, too. We've seen cases like this in motorsports, for example, where, you know, an accident has claimed the life of a driver. And after some years of, you know, kind of study, someone is charged, you know, personally with some act of negligence, you know, causing the accident. It really doesn't solve the problem in the end, you know, as I think we're both saying. You have to go after the process, not the person.
For our main topic for this podcast, we have the crankiest of the cranky flyers. That's right, Brett Snyder from the Cranky Flyer blog. Brett, welcome.
Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, it's good to have you with us, Brett. We know that you've been quite an enthusiast for an awful long time, but maybe you can tell us sort of what the origins were of your Cranky Flyer blog. What motivated you to start blogging?
Sure. It's actually kind of funny. I like you said, I've been an enthusiast for a really long time. And so I had, you know, all my friends that most of my friends tend not to be in the industry so much, but they would tap into me as this wealth of knowledge for any time they were flying or booking a trip or anything like that. So, you know, at some point I had a couple of my friends that said, look, man, you know way too much about this stuff. You got to start putting it out somewhere. You know, someone's going to find this interesting. So I said, all right. And they bought the domain for me. They really pushed me to do it. And I'm glad they did.
Did they think of the name Cranky Flyer, or was that your invention?
No, it came from them. I don't remember exactly how it ended up being settled on, but they'd actually called me. So we went to business school together, and they had a couple of nicknames for me. One ended up being Cranky Pants, and it kind of turned into Cranky Flyer. No, it was nothing bad. It was a term of endearment. So.
Well, that's too bad to hear that didn't really work out for you, Brett.
Yeah.
Now, we noticed on your blog, and we wanted to razz you a little bit about this, but you refer to yourself as an airline dork. Now, yeah. I'm sure you're aware that geeks and dorks in history haven't necessarily gotten along too well. I think the Great Chicago Fire was actually caused by a rumble between the two.
Yes, well, I actually picked that one up in college. I went to George Washington University, and when I was there, I took some classes with Daryl Jenkins. Well, so, you know, Daryl always kind of instilled it that, you know, we were a band of airline dorks, so I kind of stuck with that one.
All right, we'll forgive you this time, I suppose.
All right, thanks.
Since I guess technically it is all kind of the same thing, so.
Yeah, you know.
Let's talk airplanes. There's so much going on. And a couple things that I wanted to get your take on. The first being, and you seem to be well-tuned to what's going on out in the Rockies, and that is what is happening with the cage match that is Denver.
Yeah, Denver is it's a heck of a place these days. I think it's great to be living there right now. You've got more options than just about anyone. But, I'm not sure. It, of course, seems like Southwest is building up extremely quickly there, so clearly they've got their eyes on Denver. You know, part of that has to be, in my mind, marginalizing Frontier if they can. So, but you know, looking at United, they could be working on United as well. So
yeah, and that question's come up in some of the industry forums. Is it, on the surface, it really seems that Southwest is going after Frontier, although some people are postulating that this may be Southwest has written Frontier off, and they're now going after United in this market.
Yeah, you know, you could say that, but it's such a different product, you know, between United and Southwest. If you're traveling in coach, you'd probably rather fly Southwest anyway. But you know, the business travelers, the elite members, you know, I just can't see those people moving over to Southwest.
Well, with bag fees and Saturday night stay requirements, we'll see if that holds true.
Well, the elites don't have to pay the bag fees. They give them a pass on all that stuff.
Oh, good.
Yeah, good for them. But yeah, it's interesting to see what's going on there. I mean, Frontier's not in a good spot. I don't know if you saw their May earnings report, but it was ugly.
You know, I did, and it's really unfortunate because I'm still just not optimistic at all about the animal tails out there, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm with you. I had an opportunity to fly them for the first time last year. Actually, took them on two separate trips, and I mean, I really like flying them. You know, I really thought it was a good experience, but you know, it is unfortunate to see, but it's, I guess, the way things go.
Now, moving then into you know, talking about moving from one airline who has the newer equipment to what seems to be the Cinderella story of the industry lately, and that's Allegiant Airlines. And you just mentioned on your BNet blog that they posted a 94% load factor for June.
Yeah, that's pretty unreal, isn't it?
How do you do that?
How do you do that? Well, I mean, I think if you think about it, Allegiant's really targeting, you know, the leisure traveler, right? They're trying to bring people to Vegas and Florida, Arizona now. You know, most of their system is centered around that sort of model. And so I think when you're flying a couple times a week, you're really looking at talking to, you know, customers that are going to be flexible with their times. And so it seems to me that they've just done a good job of scheduling things at times where people are willing to work around their schedule, and they're just filling it up. I mean, they don't really seem to worry about frequency. You know, it's all about just filling those leisure planes. It's just such a different model than what other people are doing.
Brett, do you think they've, you know, found a niche, or do you think they've found a sort of a model that others can emulate with the same level of success? You have an opinion on that?
I don't know if you know, it's definitely a niche, because business travelers could never deal with an airline like that, right? Because they don't, you know, they fly a couple times a week. It's definitely a niche. The question is, how big is it, and is there room for more people to come in there? You know, I don't know. We'll see. They're pretty effective at doing it so far, and they've got some of the major, you know, major leisure destinations covered, but they've kind of moved into a couple different areas, like with that Bellingham base they're doing, you know, up near the Canadian border there. Starting to fly to San Francisco and San Diego, which is moving the base more from where the base is the leisure destination. It's putting the base where, I guess, where the people are coming from. It's kind of
Right.
reverse. I don't know.
Now, Bellingham, of course, that's was there ever any airline service before Skybus's failed experiment, or is this just a direct result of that?
You know, I don't remember if anyone was there before. It's possible that someone was, but is it a direct result of that? I don't think so. They may have even flown there since before Skybus. I know they used to run. I mean, they've been running Bellingham to Vegas for quite some time. I think I remember a year or two ago they were running Bellingham to Palm Springs. So I think what they ended up doing is maybe they just started seeing some good opportunities up there. I'm yeah, it's really interesting to see it, and you kind of makes you wonder what's going to be next.
Now, there's been some speculation in the industry that this isn't necessarily a profitable airline, more so a subsidized version of Ryanair, where the ancillary revenues really are kind of outside the industry in the travel sector, and they're kind of subsidizing what is the airline costs. Is this something that we're going to see going into the future, do you think, or is this going to run dry?
Yeah, I don't see why it would run dry. It's certainly not everyone's taste. Not everyone wants to, you know, pay for every little thing when they're flying. Then again, everyone is sort of moving to that model, with the exception of Southwest at this point. But
Ironically.
ironic, yeah, it's funny. But yeah, I don't know. I think these guys have a model that's clearly working for them, and they're really not touching other airlines. You look at where they're flying, right? Most of the time, they're the only airline in town. And so, is it possible that someone else could come in there with like a full service product into, I don't know, Peoria or some of these other airports? I don't even know where a lot of them are. I know they just announced Grand Forks, Great For Grand Forks, North Dakota. Places like that. I have to think anyone in that area is just going to be happy with the service that they have instead of having to drive somewhere else. So, Allegiant's figured out, all right, well, to make this service work, we're going to have to charge, X amount for this, and we're going to need to get hotel revenues and car rental revenues and, all that sort of stuff.
Now, my original hometown is up near South Bend, Indiana, where Allegiant does quite a bit of flying too. I say quite a bit, but that's what, two flights a week to Las Vegas. And I could tell you what happened up there was people heard that there's an airline flying nonstop to Vegas, and the people didn't necessarily think, oh, well, I was thinking about going to Vegas, so I think I'll take this airline instead. No, they saw this news and then said, hey, honey, you want to go to Vegas? But what concerns me about that is what happens when everybody's already been to Vegas?
Well, then they just go again.
Yeah.
But you look at Vegas right now. It's seen number of flights has just dropped dramatically, or number of seats, I guess. More importantly than that, I tend to think that if Allegiant is able to kind of hold all these, keep all these flights going to all these places, which we haven't really seen them cutting that much permanently. I mean, they do a lot of seasonal stuff where they'll cut and go back and things like that. But I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, and they've had routes that have been going for several years, right? So.
And that brings up another good point, or another good question, and that is Allegiant uses the exact opposite methodology that we would expect from these high fuel costs. Instead of getting the newer, more fuel-efficient aircraft, they're going for the older, cheaper, yet fuel hogs in the MD-80s. And it's working magnificently, at least it seems to be that way. Are they onto something here?
Well, it's really interesting because one of the biggest issues in this industry has always been the high fixed costs and low variable costs. And so, people fly these things around, even if the flights aren't covering the fixed costs, well, they got to put these planes up in the air. So you end up having problems with that. So Allegiant has so much more flexibility, just being able to park these planes if they want, right? Because the variable cost is a much greater percentage for them. So, yeah, it makes a lot of sense for guys like that, I think, where they can just get these old planes for cheap and park them for an entire month. If September's a low month in Florida, like, all right, just put them on the ground for a little while. That's pretty cool.
I mean, you gotta give them credit for their audacity at the very least, I suppose.
Yeah, hey, I just gotta give them credit that they're actually making money.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's a feat in itself in this industry right now, so.
So, with the glut of 737-300s and 500s and 400s in the desert, who else does this?
Yeah, there are a bunch of those that are going to be sitting out there, aren't there?
There are.
Yeah. If they're sitting out there, that's the thing, right? Because you get American with all these MD-80s, but they don't, I'm assuming they don't have them for that cheap because they got these things when they were new, long ago. So definitely the key to that is getting them when they're sitting out in the desert. But yeah, I don't know who's going to pick those up, if anyone, right now. I think you'd be crazy to try and start anything right now.
So now compare this strategy with, say, Delta Airlines, who they've just emerged from bankruptcy. They've secured some extremely advantageous financing and lease rates for their MD-80s, and yet they're still replacing their MD-80 fleet.
Well, Delta, they seem like they've kind of gone with this more upscale strategy lately, don't you think?
They still seem to be subscribing to the newer, more expensive yet less fuel efficient, or excuse me, more fuel efficient aircraft.
Well, they're also going with this whole, we're going to put in-flight entertainment in your seat backs, and they've done more with like refurbishing the interiors. So, I look at that and think, well, the MD-80, that doesn't even have overhead screens on the thing. So if that's really not fitting in their fleet plan with that, then that's one thing. But the other thing too is, like I said with American, I don't think these MD-80s are that cheap for them because they didn't get them secondhand.
Nor have they had the bankruptcy filing to allow them to renegotiate those either. That's a good point.
Well, yeah, Delta, they were in bankruptcy, but I don't remember I don't know what they got with those.
You know how the rumor mill works, but the last I had heard, they were Delta was paying less on the MD-80s than they were on their CRJ-700s.
Amazing, huh?
There's definitely, you know, outside of Allegiant, there's not much of a market for them. So South America or Africa, maybe. I'm not sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, as always, Max and I have a couple word associations for you. We like to do this with all of our guests because we want to make sure that you feel as uncomfortable as possible for a couple seconds.
Excellent.
So, of course, the rules of the game, you know, the first word that comes to mind after each of the words, you can qualify it a bit if you'd like. The more you make a fool of yourself, the better.
Oh,
basically.
Great.
Max and I have very effectively ruined our reputations in the industry with these.
Yeah. Excellent.
And we want to share the fun.
So, Max, you had a couple?
Yeah, I have a few. We can play sort of alphabet soup, Brett. I've got some organizations here that you'll probably recognize them from their acronyms, but if you don't, you know, please let us know, but I think you'll find all these familiar.
All right, and one word, right? Just one word.
You can have a phrase. We'll be nice.
All right.
Okay, first word or first acronym? FAA.
Lumbering. How about that? Well, I can elaborate if you want.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, I look at right now with what's happening, how capacity is decreasing, and, you know, delays are going to be better this summer because there's less capacity. So this is the perfect time to just be able to make changes, you know, prepare for the future, all this kind of stuff. And I know it's just going to get stuck in political, you know, back and forth and infighting, and nothing's going to get done.
Okay, and working off that, I'll give you the next one, which is ATC.
Yeah, in need of improvement. Well, it's, again, I don't think it's going to be as big of an issue this year because capacity's down, but we need to think way ahead. And, you know, sure, the anything we can do to improve air traffic handling in this country is good, but I think, you know, all this free flight and all that exciting stuff, it all sounds good, but still you're going to have problems at the airport level, and that's always going to be the bottleneck, I think, for now.
Do you think they're moving along fast enough with next generation ATC?
Right.
I know, I throw a loaded question, right?
I mean, I haven't heard anything lately because they still haven't gotten reauthorized yet, right? That's still
right.
Sitting in Congress. I mean, it's just, oh, God. This happened after September 11th, too, when capacity went down. You know, people kind of said, oh, well, everything's fine, no delays, and nothing got fixed. And then guess what? It all came back once we got more capacity.
And it's a matter of concrete. I mean, there's not enough pavement out there. The air gets backed up because there's not enough concrete to park these airplanes and at least to land them all at once.
Yeah, that's why I hear that thing, you know, when President Bush rolled out his, you know, airspace over the water that you can use during the holidays.
Well,
like, dude, unless you can throw out a couple more runways,
yeah, what's the point?
Problems.
All right, well, continuing this vein, how about the next one, TSA?
I have mixed feelings on these guys. I really do. Trying to think of what a good phrase would be. Maybe just mixed feelings. I don't know. You know, some things that they do, I don't know if you guys read their blog.
Yes, that's very, well, you try to. You have to try to weed through the comments that are, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, no question. But they really, it's pretty impressive. They do kind of put themselves out there.
I thought that was very unusual for a government operation. And I really give them a lot of credit for, you know, kind of having the guts to do that.
Yeah, I agree. I was skeptical when they first put it out. But it really, if you look through it, they've done a pretty good job with it of explaining what's going on. And you know, I do feel sorry for a lot of the people that are working the front line and get yelled at every day because a lot of times they're following orders. But
sure.
I have to wonder about a lot of the policies that are still out there. And, you know, I love the idea, like the behavioral detection officers. I think that's great. I think, you know, it's not that intrusive unless you see something. And,
right.
You know, if they see something, okay, you go through secondary screening. But, you know, it's a lot better than telling me I can't bring my Coke through security.
Right.
Exactly. I think they've taken some good cues from, you know, other security operations around the world, notably the Israeli you know, security strategy, which is, of course, very heavily behavioral oriented.
Yeah, which I'm sure this is, you know, pales in comparison, but it's still taking a good step to just identify another way to look at it. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, they still make it so difficult for people to travel, and it goes back to, you know, the trade-off of civil liberties versus perceived safety, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I tend to think we've gone too far with it, but that's just me.
All right, Max, I've got three, or excuse me, Brett, I've got three for you then. The first word is first class.
Not as good as it used to be. Well, I'm thinking from a domestic perspective. I actually had someone write a guest post on my blog when I was gone a couple weeks ago. And yeah, he was lamenting the decline of first class. And you know, a lot of people objected to that, saying, hey, you know, go fly Emirates, go fly Singapore, and first class is alive and well. But if you're talking about the U.S. industry, I think first class is it's not really that exciting, to be honest. I mean, I'm not a tall guy, so I don't really need the legroom that much. I just think it's kind of an upgrade instrument. It's a loyalty tool, right? Keeps people kind of loyal if they're frequent flyers because they can get their upgrades.
Yeah, that's it entirely. It's all frequent flyers up there.
Yeah, yeah. Except for like Virgin America. I haven't been on their first class yet, but it looks pretty good.
Hmm.
I almost actually bought, I flew them in coach, and I almost bought a first class ticket because it wasn't that much more, but I just didn't do it at the time. Maybe I'll do it on my next trip.
Good. Okay, the next word is cranky flyer.
Best ever. Oh, right, you meant cranky flyers, not the blog. Oh, my bad. There are so many cranky flyers out there. It's tough. It's really unfortunate. You think about how it should be such an exciting thing just to be going somewhere, and it's just become so hard that I think people just get so cranky when they're flying. It just becomes a tough experience for everyone.
Sometimes they make great theater for the rest of us, though.
Oh, yeah, no question about that. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, that was a stroke of marketing genius on your part, Brett, because people searching for travel blogs and they see Cranky Flyer, they say, hey, that's me.
I can relate to that.
Yeah, sadly, I'd love it if no one was cranky and everything was a rosy, happy, fun experience, but it doesn't seem to be going that way.
Okay, the last word then, airplane geeks.
Coolest ever.
No. All right, I like this.
There are so few people left, I think, that really find like a romance and a excitement in flying. It used to be that, you know, everyone thought it was so cool. You go to the airport, you watch the planes, and you get the wings from the pilot when you're a kid or something. And it just seems like it gets harder and harder to pull out, you know, the excitement from it. But, you know, when I'm sitting out there watching planes go by, like the excitement's still there, as difficult as it is. But there's still that, you know, the airplane geeks, the group of people that can really, like, continue to see the joy in it and makes it at least somewhat fun again.
Well, I'll tell you, you don't have to explain yourself on this podcast because we are the ones who agree with you.
Yeah.
On that
it's,
one. So.
It's contagious, you know? I mean, I take friends out. You know, I think everyone knows about the In-N-Out at the end of the L.A. runways at LAX. And, you know, I take friends out there and say, hey, let's go to In-N-Out, you know, get a burger. No one turns that down. They're like, wait a minute. We're here to watch airplanes?
Ha ha ha. I have fooled you.
Yeah. But you know what? When they get there, they actually like it. They're like, oh, you know, it's kind of fun. It's cool to see these big guys flying over. And it's good. There's a good place in the world for airplane geeks.
Well, thank you so much, Brett. For all the listeners, please make sure that you go to his blogs. He's on the BNet Travel blog. Also, of course, the Cranky Flyer blog, where, Brett, your blog is probably most well-known for having such an active comment base. So we ask all our listeners to join in on the comments.
You don't have to know what you're talking about. Everyone's friendly. No one's going to jump on you. Now, there are some forums where, you know, you get scared to post a comment on there because people will jump on you. But I haven't seen that on here for the most part.
And I can vouch for that myself. So, Brett, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any parting words of wisdom?
Parting words? I don't know. I think it's great that you guys are doing this. I think, you know, it's always fun to just talk about this stuff, and I have conversations like this just with friends in the industry all the time, and it's kind of nice to have something like this and just put it out there for other people to hear as well.
Now, Max is going to tell us about the pick of the week.
All right, Court. Today's pick of the week, this week's pick, SolidWorksPilot.com. Now, this is an endeavor for a true airplane. What these folks have done is created a site where you can design your own virtual paper airplane based on different parameters that you select. It constructs, if you will, the virtual airplane. You get to launch it and see how far this thing will fly. You can control several aspects of the flight. There's a little man that's going to throw this paper airplane on your computer screen, and you can adjust the strength of the throw and the angle of the throw, and the thing flies through the air, and you can measure the distance that it flies. Now, this takes a little bit of practice. It's very easy to overthrow and have the thing loop around behind and land behind you, or you know, there's some other paper disasters awaiting you depending on your design and how you launch the thing. But try it. After a little while, you get better and better. And there's even a feature built into it where you can challenge your friends to a competition where they can design their own paper airplanes, their own virtual paper airplanes, and you can see who gets the greatest distance. Now, I understand Courtney's been, I won't say practicing, I'll just say trying this a little bit. Is that right, Court?
Yeah. You know, Max, I've never been addicted to crack, but I'm certain that if I had, it would feel a lot like I feel when I'm on this website.
Yes, yes.
It's this love-hate. I can't get away with it or get away from it, and it makes me so angry, but I just got to keep trying. You guys will know what we're talking about. Go to the site. Whenever you throw it too hard, it kind of makes a loop and comes back and falls right in front of the guy, and he lets out a little curse word and, you know, the different characters and stuff. But
and you feel really stupid.
Yeah, it feels like that's all I could get the guy to do is curse. But this is a lot of fun. It really is, and it's so addicting. So if you have a lot of things to do, I would suggest that you not visit the site for too long because you will be addicted to it. For true airplane geeks.
That's right. And again, it's solidworkspilot.com.
Thank you, Max, for that complete waste
of
my
time.
Oh, man, I'll tell you. I can't get away from it.
It's fun, though. And you're right. It is addictive.
We did get quite a few emails this week, Max. And the first comes from Chris. Now, Chris is an Australian who's actually living in London. And Chris says, first off, I love the podcast. It's very cool. You have a good mix of civil, general, and military aviation. Thank you very much, Chris. He goes on to say, something I've been following over the internet for a long time is the whole debacle over the U.S. Air Force tanker program. Something I don't really understand is the whole furor that has been kicked off by it. It would be great if you could spend some time on that for your foreign listeners. Why is it okay for European nations to have a mixed domestic foreign inventory, but not the USA? And I have to say, Chris, this, if nothing else, this has definitely prompted me to get more information about what's going on with this tanker deal, because I think it's very easy for all of us, myself included, especially as we read through the initial articles, it's very easy for us to oversimplify. Digging into this is an extremely complex situation that we've got going on here.
Yeah, it really is. There are, you know, a number of players, both, you know, in the government, in the military, in the companies that stand to make or forego a lot of revenue, in the people that work for those companies, so there's employment issues. There's just a lot of different angles to this from a lot of different people.
And several of the main issues. This isn't as easy as people just want the tanker to be a U.S. product. It really there's so many issues going on. One of them being the suit that the United States has with the World Trade Organization against Airbus, saying that they've been using illegal subsidies to do research and build their aircraft program. Now, the EU has the same suit against Boeing and the U.S., but I think what's important to point out here is that the United States is suing Airbus, saying that they're using illegal subsidies, and then the U.S. turns around and chooses Airbus over Boeing as a result of those same subsidies. Not that there's any real hypocrisy going on, it just really hurts their case because, you know, think of it in the terms of if France were to say that Boeing is cheating, such as they are doing, and then France turns around and orders a bunch of Boeing aircraft over, the government orders Boeing aircraft over Airbus aircraft, or Germany, which in fact they have been given the opportunity and those countries have turned it down. So you have a very political atmosphere, but both France and Germany have put out RFPs for tankers and they just excluded Boeing. In fact, they required that it be a European product. The U.S. did not do that.
There is a nationalistic kind of, you know, component to the, you know, to the issue. And, you know, it sounds good and it appeals to the emotion of a lot of people, but, you know, in the end, I think it's becoming less and less relevant. You know, the aerospace industry, like many other industries, for example, the auto industry, you know, has really, you know, moved away from, you know, products that are the result or the product of one particular country. And it's really an international business. You know, there's suppliers to Boeing all over the world. There's suppliers to Eads and Airbus all over the world. You know, suppliers, companies that are suppliers to each other are also customers of each other. It's really intertwined. And to say that, you know, a Boeing tanker is an American product and that a Northrop Grumman tanker is a, you know, European product, it really isn't very accurate anymore. But it does appeal to special interests and people who are looking out for their own best interests. But in the end, it in my opinion anyway, it's really kind of a non-issue. The decision really should be made on the basis of, you know, the quality of the proposal.
Now, the impression that I've been getting from the people who are more vocal in this isn't necessarily a U.S. versus Europe mentality. No, this is a Washington State versus Alabama mentality. I mean, these two states are really at odds with each other, mostly because the 767 tanker version was going to be built, of course, in Everett, Washington, and the A330 version of the tanker would have been assembled in Alabama. Where Northrop Grumman was going to build a facility to build those there. So that's where the most of the tension seems to be coming from. I know there are some other distinct differences between the aircraft. The big issue that seems to be coming out of this, and Max, you and I brought this up right away before knowing exactly the story behind this, but our first question was, why did they do the 767-200 platform when Airbus went with the A330 platform? Isn't the 767-300, even the 400 better, or maybe even the 777? And that's really the crux of the issue with this, and that is the Air Force put out the requirements for this tanker. They specifically said that exceeding these requirements will do absolutely nothing. It will just add cost.
Right, no extra points.
Right, and that was the phrase. Do not exceed the requirements. And Boeing did that to the T. The 767-200 meets the requirements most closely. Now, the Air Force looked at the A330 and they said, oh, wow, we could do this with it and we could do that and we could carry some cargo with it. And it is more expensive, but there's more stuff we can do with it. They never mentioned that to Boeing because Boeing could have come out with an airframe to do all that. So after saying that no extra points would be given, they went ahead and gave extra points and, in fact, awarded the contract. And now that people are looking into this, it seems that this wasn't as transparent as they had originally thought, of course, with the GAO response and their recommendation for them to look back into it, it has really been a magnifying glass has been taken to this process. Another thing I did want to point out that the GAO did say that they thought the survivability of the 767 version would have been higher. We'll see how much that plays on the politics here. Of course, being an election year, this is just going to be magnified. So,
well, that's just it. Because the real question now is, what are they going to do next? How are they going to deal with this?
Right, and that's where our last news article, as we kind of jump this around, because we did want to bring this up in the in response to Chris's email. This comes from SeattlePI.com. The article is, "The Pentagon to outline new tanker strategy very soon." Apparently, Defense Secretary Robert Gates may, quote-unquote, very soon announce his new strategy for buying aerial refueling tankers. He says, "I think that very soon," not wanting to put any time frames on it, "but very soon we'll be talking about what we think is the best way to proceed."
Interestingly enough, Gates has said that he's been doing some consulting with experts and giving his own analysis of the options. So it sounds like Gates is you know, personally trying to take a leadership role here in crafting a strategy that's going to make sense going forward.
The tone of this article seemed to suggest, and I don't want to throw anything into it that's not there, but Max, I kind of got the feeling that they may be talking of sort of a hybrid, more expensive, but kind of a hybrid solution that I think you had mentioned. Another news article that we did not review here is that Boeing is going to go ahead and create the tanker anyway.
Yeah, you know, it's a political issue, and it's going to have a, in my opinion anyway, a political solution that's probably going to involve some kind of a compromise. I mean, you don't want the Air Force to come off of this looking really stupid. And they're looking for a face-saving kind of a solution. One possibility, you know, might be splitting the order. The Air Force apparently found some things they liked about the A330 variant that, even though it was beyond what they asked for, obviously since they selected it, there's some, you know, aspects of that proposal they liked. So, you know, maybe we'll see a dual award kind of a strategy. Maybe Gates has something else in mind, but you know, he needs to satisfy the Air Force. He needs to get these tankers on contract so they can get built and deployed. Congress at the same time is looking at all this, saying, you know, what are you guys doing? And they're calling for you know, testimony, and subcommittees want to, you know, review this. So the sooner Gates gets to a solution that is going to, you know, work for everybody, you know, the easier this whole thing becomes, and the quicker it gets resolved.
Yeah, and I think, and for Chris, the big reason that this has come up so much, and as I've been following the news stories as they come out, as the announcement was made to go with EADS and to go with the Northrop Grumman solution of the A330 tanker, a lot of experts in the industry said, well, you know, they've got a reason. You know, it's the better airplane, obviously. Right, Air Force? And the Air Force kind of went, they're having a very hard time justifying their conclusions, because apparently the documentation process of this RFP isn't strong enough. It gets back to the transparency of it, and you know, the ignition of going with a European company when an American company offers the same product. You know, like you say, Max, it's really a worldwide economy anyways, but to the perception of the American taxpayer, you know, that was enough to ignite the situation. And as they started looking into it, this has turned into a sort of a fiasco for the Air Force. And don't forget, you know, time is ticking. The answer seems to be, well, let Boeing respond with an A330-like style. But in order for them to do the R&D on maybe a larger version of the 767 or even the 777, the Air Force is using these KC-135, which are, for the better part, re-engine 707s that are flying the tanker fleet. I mean, time is definitely ticking.
Yeah, if they have to rebid, if Boeing has to rebid based on a different aircraft, unless they've been hedging their bets and have been working it in parallel, then we're 2 years away from this thing. But I guess the next milestone, I think, is the July 10th House hearing on the subject. So we may get a better view of, you know, where we're headed with this after that hearing on July 10th.
So thanks to Chris for sending the email. Please, for those of you, don't hesitate to send emails, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We do have another one to get into, but I wanted to say thanks for Chris. Quite a long, well-thought-out email. He is truly an airplane geek like us, so we appreciate it, Chris. We also got an email from Jorge on the situation that pilots are seeing in the industry. He says he's a recent high school graduate trying to decide on a career. I love flying, but was thinking about becoming a commercial pilot or air traffic controller, but all things I hear have me worried about my future career choice. I have been looking around at different pilot job listing sites and seeing that almost all jobs are for flight instructors and nothing for freight, sightseeing, or air taxi stuff. Will us hopeful pilots have to look for out-of-country jobs? Or basically, what do you think will happen to the pilots of tomorrow?
An excellent question, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And one that we really haven't touched on, and that is the, you know, what's happening to the pilot profession. Jorge, I wish I had that crystal ball, but what I can tell you is that there is always going to be need for pilots. It's just a question of how many pilots there are and how many open seats there are. It is difficult to get into the industry. I would say that it's a little bit less difficult now than it has been. They have some airline-specific programs. A lot of them are based out in Florida that you can go and go to, and I think after 6 months to a year, you can come out with enough multi-time and total time to interview with a regional airline. There's always the military, of course. But as far as the pilot job still being there, there's always going to be the need for people to fly airplanes. I mean, shoot, we're still driving trains all over the country. We're going to still need airplane pilots. As far as finding those jobs, and I think that's a very good question, because you're not going to open a newspaper, go to the classified section, and find a job listing for a pilot. There are several resources. Max, I know that you had a few. The one that I had, a couple that I had, climbto350.com is a very good pilot job resource. You can get at least a good idea of what jobs are out there without registering. It is a pay site if you want to apply for the jobs. Every once in a while you'll see some pop up on Monster Career Builder. There's avianation.com, there's avjobs.com. So they're out there. You're just not seeing them on the more popular sites or classified ads. So don't fret. There's a lot of jobs out there for pilots. It looks frustrating, but it's not as bad as it may look.
Yeah, and there's some other options too that occurred to me. You know, there are a number of aviation forums that are, you know, frequented by people in the aviation industry, pilots and other groups, and that can be a good source for, you know, networking and talking about these kinds of things. There are certainly a number of other people that are have the same questions, are also pursuing careers in aviation, and a lot of them have blogs, and you can follow along with others who are asking the same questions and worrying about the same things, and that can be another resource for you to follow along and try to get some answers to some of the questions you have.
Don't get too frustrated. If you really want to do it, do it.
Yeah, for sure. Passion counts for a lot. If you've got that, you're well on your way.
Especially, I mean, look at this, 5 episodes.
Yes.
So speaking of that, thank you once again, Max. Thank you very much to Brett Snyder of Cranky Flyer. Go to his blog, that's crankyflyer.com. Email us, please, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Also, visit our website, leave some comments, that's airplanegeeks.com. You can visit us on iTunes, leave a comment, Podcast Alley, Blueberry, you name it, we're there. We also have our voicemail. Give us a call. We'll get you on the podcast. That's 812-757-4252. Other than that, Max, anything you wanted to add?
I think that's it. I'd like to thank everyone for listening. Hope you'll join us again next week.
Episode 6. That should be a good one, although I have no idea what it's going to be about.
But we have a week to do it.
We made it to five. Yeah, we'll do it. So thank you so much to everybody who's listened. Our downloads seem to be going up gradually, which is exciting.
Yeah, very encouraging.
Because more people are interested than those that we've turned off. So that's a good thing. So we appreciate. We can't say how much we appreciate it. So keep it coming. Tell your friends. Send us emails. Send them emails. And hopefully we can turn this into something a little bit more than us making fools of ourselves. So, okay, until next week, thank you all for joining.
Bye now.
How do I normally do it? Do you remember listening to the podcast? Is there like an intro?
Yeah. Oh, I think you just say, you know, Maxic of the Week, and then I start in.
Oh, well, that's easy.
I mean, simple as that.
Yeah, simple as that.
Court, so. Say, now Max is about the pick of the week.
Yeah. Now, Max is going to tell us about the pick of the week.